The North Carolina Reading Service presents this program for our blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week, and it's read today by John Feddersen. And the week's issue is dated to April the 19th, 2024. And we'll fade this out, and we'll get started. And we'll begin with several articles from Durham. The first, Durham Public Schools seeks a new superintendent and faces a ticking clock. As the Durham School Board launches its search for a new permanent superintendent, a consultant advising the search urged the board to move swiftly and make a final pick by this summer. Time for finding a dream superintendent is ticking for the school board, the consultant suggested, as other search processes are already underway. Monica Santana Rosen, CEO of the consulting firm Alma Advisory Group, said in a meeting on Wednesday, "The further you get into July, your best candidates are making commitments to their places of employment for the next school year. You're also going to be competing with other search processes that may be further along than you are." The new superintendent succeeds Pascal Mubenga, who resigned in February. He came under fire following a pay dispute that left over 1,000 classified staff confused and worried about their pay. Kathy Moore was announced as the interim superintendent soon after. She plans to depart before the start of the new school year. Mubenga's successor will need to navigate the aftermath of the school system's recent pay debacle. Superintendent Mubenga became aware in November that the district had promised raises to workers that were beyond the district's budget. He disclosed the shortfall to the full board 2 months later, in January, and resigned shortly thereafter. The pay dispute led to months of chaos. School was canceled several times as workers called in sick in protest. In late February, the school board approved an 11% raise for classified staff over their 22-23 pay raises. Many workers remain dissatisfied, though, as still falls below what many were making in 23 after their October pay raises. The consultant said that in the wake of the debacle, close attention to finances will be a critical part of the new superintendent's role. "This is a job you got to be looking at every single day," the consultant said. In the meeting, school board members outlined their vision for the next superintendent. Several board members shared their desires for a new leader with a strong racial equity lens, who is knowledgeable about student mental health and has a track record of improving student outcomes. The board hopes the new superintendent will have strong administration and communication skills to expand staff retention, fill vacancies, strengthen school finances, and rebuild community trust. The new superintendent also will have to oversee the Growing Together redistricting plan. Rosen, the CEO of the consulting firm, provided a proposed timeline for the search, suggesting the school board should post a job profile by April 19th. Why, that's today. And hold public forums and community surveys during April and May. The hope is that by the end of May, the board will begin meeting candidates with an eye to making a hiring decision in late June or early July. And the board plans to begin meeting biweekly to discuss the status of the search. Interim Superintendent Moore, a retired Wake County School Superintendent, has borne the burden of having to navigate pay changes and worker discontent in the wake of the pay dispute. The new superintendent will take over Moore's efforts and will have to continue to repair and address the flawed pay scale. Board member Jessica Carda-Oten says, "Any leader will need to be able to navigate that challenge at the district level and then the school level." The vote on the new superintendent will likely come in July, when the board composition will have changed to current members Javonia Lewis and Alejandra Valadares will depart the board in late June. Two newly elected members, Wendell Tabb and Joy Harrell, will be sworn in on July 1. Several board members voiced their hope for the process to move more quickly so that current members could vote on the matter. Again from Durham, residents weigh in on a proposed redevelopment of Lakewood Shopping Center. That's been a commercial hub in Durham for decades. Now, a developer has plans to revitalize the shopping district, and residents in the surrounding neighborhoods want to have a say in its future. On Tuesday evening, residents weighed in on the potential redevelopment of the shopping center during a virtual meeting hosted by Morningstar Law Group, the law firm representing Brody Co., the developer of the proposed project. Brody Co. is a Greenville, North Carolina-based development firm with 9 projects in the state, including Lakewood, according to the firm's website. The company mostly works on developing commercial centers. The site proposed for redevelopment is roughly 8.5 acres and includes about half the shopping center located adjacent to the Food Lion. Scrap Exchange, the reuse art center that purchased 10-acre portion of the district in 2016, has been the other anchor tenant in the district since moving to Lakewood in 2014. Neil Ghosh, a spokesperson for Morningstar, said Brody Co. plans to revitalize the district and refresh the retail storefronts on each portion of the property by updating facades and changing the size of the units to make them more affordable for local small businesses. The firm also plans to redesign the parking lot by adding more plants and sidewalks to make the large lot safer and easier to navigate for pedestrians. Ghosh said that tenants have complained about drag racing in the large, often empty parking lot. The plan also includes adding climate-controlled self-storage to a portion of the site, which Ghosh said will help underwrite improvements to that project overall. He added the aesthetic of the storage space would resemble that of apartment units to help them blend into the property. Ghosh said this allows Brody Co. to recapitalize the property while maintaining the center as a primarily retail location. Additionally, self-storage is a low-traffic, low-intensity, low-utility use, so the center will not be overburdened by this. But it will create another kind of anchor that will give the shopping center more stability in the long run. Many residents voiced concerns during the Q&A portion of this meeting about the lack of housing in the plan and said the self-storage added little value to the community. Several comments came in through the chat function on the Zoom call, which had about 200 participants. Barbara Schombaltfalvi, a resident, said, "You're basically saying the storage is the cash cow to support the rest of the property. What types of studies have you done that support that thinking?" Emil Smith, "What is your metric for this being beneficial? Where are thriving communities demanding self-storage? Move this to U.S. 15501, not a residential neighborhood." Lakewood has struggled to maintain its once vibrant attractions. The shopping center was previously home to a movie theater and a small amusement park early in its history. Over the years, it has lost its appeal as shopping malls and brick-and-mortar retail has declined. Food Lion has remained an anchor tenant for decades, and other service-oriented businesses like El Centro and Lincoln Community Health Center have found success in the district. No matter what Brody Co. chooses to develop, it will have a significant impact on the rest of that shopping center, which is mostly owned by the Scrap Exchange. Ghosh said the two groups have been in communication about future plans, but no formal collaboration is expected. In an op-ed for the Indy in 2017, Ann Woodard, the former executive director at Scrap Exchange, put forth a grand vision for the declining shopping center. The plan included a reimagination of the entire site with scrap exchange as the driving force. And she wrote, "Our long-term vision for Reuse Arts District is one-of-a-kind destination with makerspace and shops, art studios, galleries, artist marketplaces, gardens, a sculpture park, architectural salvage operations, affordable housing, a shipping container mall, and more. The near-term plan is to lease space in order to generate income to cover the financing costs. As part of that process, the scrap exchange will operate an 18,000-square-foot retail thrift store that can serve as an anchor tenant for the shopping center." It's unclear how the two sites will manage the redevelopment of the long-standing commercial tent pole of the Lakewood neighborhood. Renderings of the site were shared during the meeting, but no official development plan has been submitted to the City of Durham Planning Department yet, said Ghosh. Brody Co. will have to request a rezoning for the property to specifically include self-storage, which is not allowed under the city's current zoning map. The development proposal will go before the Durham Planning Commission before the City Council considers it during a public hearing. Also from Durham, we're chugging along in our Durham segment of the program. Red Start Foods will open a dining and retail space in North Durham. Durham chef Matt Northup is comfortable cooking with a bit of contradiction. Take Red Start Foods, the meal delivery and ingredient company that he opened in 2015. It's a prepared meal service, sure, but as he stressed in an indie profile back in 2022, the meals he prepares fulfill a different niche than your average weeknight meal kit. Quote, "Our whole thing has always been that just because we're a prepared meal company, it doesn't have to be lasagna every week. We do things like that too, but we also try to have a more ambitious food." Customers have responded in kind. Northup says he and his team now fulfill around 300 orders in the Triangle every week out of the North Durham Commercial Kitchen where the business is based. Now, as first reported by the News and Observer, Northup and his wife and business partner, the artist Jordan Grace Owens, are expanding with a dining and retail space at the storefront adjoining the kitchen. On a phone call, Northup said he hopes to open by midsummer. The new cafe is called Red Start Takeaway, though that doesn't mean you actually have to take your meals away. "You'll be able to eat inside," he clarified in a press release. "I understand that calling the business takeaway is confusing. I sort of like that, too." He says that takeaway will offer daily breakfast and lunch fare, including pastries from Union Special, alongside retail items that include grab-and-grow, Red Start meals, and pantry goods. On weekends, takeaway will have evening hours with a bar space that serves wine and beer and a dinner menu drawn from Red Start favorites. To that point, recent playful herbaceous features from the Red Start website menu, try saying that 10 times, Red Start website menu, include fried chicken cutlets with pimento labneh, hot honey and dill, fermented carrot hot sauce, and golden beets with orange mint. Northup got his start with kitchen stints at Whole Foods, Pizzeria Toro, and Rose's Meat Market and Sweet Shop before founding Red Start Foods. The business originally began as a catering service, but shifted, as many food enterprises did, to a new model during the pandemic. The evolution stuck. Now it's evolving again. Let's see. Owens, his partner, said, "Our goal for takeaway to feel like a neighborhood hangout and market. Our family lives less than a mile from the location, and we're kind of just opening the space that we wish existed." Both Red Start Enterprises are located off North Roxborough Street next to the Coffee Gallery space, Perfect Lovers. local butchery business, Moonbelly Meats, rents the commissary kitchen from Northup and will continue to share the space, he says. By the way, Moonbelly Meats is one of the subjects of our next article. Anyhow, Northup says he plans to fix up the spacious patio in the back and open it for cafe use, and the parking will be available in a Red Start lot behind the business. Owens said in the press release, Red Start is known for food that's surprising and weird in the best way. I hope to cultivate some of that same creative energy in the new space. Well, on to that Moonbelly-related article. Durham Farmers Market customers are upset after a vendor's products are restricted. As the Durham Farmers Market prepares for its new season, some customers are seeking clarity from the marketing board following a decision to restrict the products one vendor is allowed to sell. Starting April 6th, the sausage and charcuterie business Moonbelly Meat Company will no longer be permitted to sell bacon, Italian sausage, breakfast sausage, or hot dogs at the farmer market due to, quote, concerns of product overlap from the marketing board, wrote Moonbelly owner Anna Gibala, a guest vendor at that market since 2022, wrote on Instagram last week. Gibala's post was diplomatic. Just a heads up, she wrote. Be on the lookout for future menu modifications. But the post generated something of an outcry, with dozens of market goers, including several vendors, sounding alarm bells and demanding the board explain its rationale. Many noted that product overlap at Durham Farmers is common. One commenter wrote, can customers not choose who they want to purchase products from at the market? There is overlap in many products, flowers, produce, bakeries. Why should this be any different? The Brook Ferments is a plant-based protein vendor, says, we're disappointed to hear this, and we stand with you, Anna. All vendors, including us, benefit from consumer choice and quality products like yours. Beyond the four products that have been banned, Moonbelly's rotating menu includes beer brats, currywurst, chorizo, rillette, pâté, prepared broths, and sausages that come in flavors like Korean barbecue, pho soup, and cheesy pizza. Gibala wrote when the indie reached out to her for comment, while I understand the concern about overlap, I feel that all vendors should be able to sell what they want, as it reasonably pertains to what kind of vendor they are. She continued, a market that offers a variety of options, even regarding one specific type of product, helps bring in a more diverse customer base. Bringing more folks to the market helps everyone. Besides Moonbelly, seven meat vendors are slated to have stands at this market during its main season, which began on April the 6th. Of those seven vendors, only two have any apparent product overlap with Moonbelly. That's the Chapel Hill Creamery, which sells Italian sausage and breakfast sausage, and Fickle Creek Farm, which sells Italian breakfast and bacon. The other five meat vendors sell poultry, lamb, beef, bison, and ostrich, but not pork. Fickle Creek Farm manager Noah Runnels is on the board of the farmers market, leading some community members to raise concerns over a potential conflict of interest. Fickle Creek was not available for comment. In an email to the Indy, the market manager, Caitlin Breedlove, wrote, quote, yes, there is currently a farmer meat vendor on the board. The board was specifically designed in its size and decision-making procedures to mitigate any individual member's personal interest. All decisions made by the board must be done so by a majority vote. Breedlove also wrote, the restriction on Moonbelly is, quote, not without precedent, but did not expand on how that rule has been applied to other current or former vendors. For guest vendors like Moonbelly, Breedlove wrote, the market rules specifically state that the board has the power to approve or reject proposed products and, quote, only products that complement the current product mix at the farmer's market will be considered. In the market rules, a guest vendor is specified as, quote, a non-member who offers a product or service that enhances the overall market. The rules state the guest vendors, quote, do not attain any of the privileges of membership, like seniority, space reservations, or voting rights. There are several dozen member vendors at the market, including a fresh pasta business, a compost products business, and two photography businesses. Zibala applied to be a member vendor, but was approved as a guest. She'll be one of six guest vendors. Breedlove wrote about the product restriction. Decisions like these are never easy. The board of directors discussed at length how to make the market a tenable option for Moonbelly, while also acknowledging our current meat farmers rely on the sales of similar products to continue operating. Moonbelly is the only non-farmer meat vendor at the farmer's market. As the Indy reported when Moonbelly launched 2 years ago, Zibala's background is in butchery. She operates the business out of the commissary kitchen at Red Start Foods in North Durham and sources her pork from Randleman's Farm, 45 minutes west of the Triangle. She came on to the sustainable foods scene with quirky flavor combinations and thoughtful branding. Moonbelly's logo, a smiling pink moon, is intended to be more approachable than the clever, heavy branding of typical butcher shops, and has since built a loyal following at the farmer's market. Zibala says the board gave her the options of either selling a full menu twice a month or a restricted menu once a week, and she chose the latter. The market is currently the only place where her product is sold. She told Indy, my business is based in the practice of whole animal butchery. Utilizing the whole animal is the most sustainable and ethical way to consume meat. Restricting the sale of bacon limits the utilization of pork belly. In this specific instance, removing bacon as a menu item throws off the strategy of whole animal butchery. According to Breedlove, the Farmers Market Board will be discussing the restriction on these products at its next meeting in April. All right. Well, this doesn't exclude Durham, because Durham is going to be as privileged to hear these cicadas as everybody else in this state. Brood, 19 cicadas are preparing to make the ascent of a lifetime. The periodic cicadas that will surface in the Triangle in coming weeks have spent 13 years underground in wooded areas and around bodies of water. We might see and hear up to a million an acre, according to Clyde Sorensen, a professor of entomology and plant pathology at NC State University. Ahead of the upcoming emergence, Indy spoke with Sorensen to learn more. This is a Q&A form. Talk to me about this year's season. What makes it so special? Anytime we have our local group of periodic cicadas emerge, it's a special thing. There are two different kinds of periodic cicadas, 17-year broods and 13-year broods. This only happens in eastern North America and nowhere else in the world. Our local brood, this brood 19 of the 13-year cicadas, and it's the largest brood in the country, so it's always cool. But this year, it's a little cooler because, even though it won't have any impact on us here in North Carolina, this brood is co-emerging with a brood of 17-year cicadas, which is located largely in Illinois and surrounding areas. When's the last time the two broods emerged at the same time? 1803. Thomas Jefferson was president. Wow, okay. So you said in the Triangle we won't be affected by the double but the 13-year cicadas will still be something to behold. What should we expect to see and when? Many people are going to have them in their yards if they have wooded yards. If folks want to go see them, there should be good numbers of them at Lake Crabtree Park, around Falls Reservoir at Falls Lake State Park, around Jordan Lake, and all around in Orange County and Chatham. In Raleigh, they're going to be mostly on the north and west sides of town. They will extend in patches all the way north of Rocky Mount. If you're in an area where they are, you could experience as many as 1 million per acre. They'll be coming up within the next couple of weeks. In 2011, they started coming up in late April, peaked in the first 10 days of May, and by the first week of June, they were pretty much gone. That could be shifted a week or more either way this year, depending on how the rest of the spring runs and what the temperatures look like. How did the 13-year cicadas impact local ecosystems? It's important to remember that they're native animals that have been here for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, so they have some impacts. But those impacts, over the grand scheme of things, are pretty ephemeral. Our brood spends 13 years in soil, feeding on tree roots. There's some evidence that the year before they emerged, they depressed the growth of trees they're feeding on because there's simply so many of them. But then they come up, they mate, they lay eggs, and they die. And after that, there's this large pulse of nutrition that goes back into the soil that those same trees can harness. There's some evidence that the year after they come up, the trees grow more. So, from the perspective of the trees, it's probably pretty much a wash. As far as other animals are concerned, everybody will eat them until they get sick of eating them. They come up in such huge numbers, local predators simply can't make much of a dent. But again, there's this pulse of nutrition. The evidence, when they come up, some bird species are more productive in terms of nesting success because there's all this protein sitting around waiting to be picked off. They don't cause any lasting harm to anything in the system. I would ask people to regard them as just a really spectacularly cool phenomenon that they only get to see once every 13 years. Could climate change have an impact on the cycles of periodic cicadas? That's a legitimate question that's receiving a fair amount of attention. 13 and 17 are both prime numbers. There are lots of interesting theories about why that is, but there is some evidence that as it gets warmer, the clocks are going to get messed up, particularly for the 13-year species, and they may shift to a shorter prime number emergence. The other problem with climate change, of course, is that when climate changes, habitats change. These are insects that evolved in hardwood forests. And if something happens to those hardwood forests due to climate change, then that habitat is going to contract. Development and land conversion have already pushed them back from where they were 500 years ago, before the Europeans came. And our activities continue to put pressure of that sort on them. They're certainly not in any danger of going extinct in the next little while. But our activities could have a profound effect on how this looks in decades, or maybe 100 years. What are some of the theories around the cicadas' prime number life cycles? People have been puzzling over this observation since it was recognized. It's pretty striking. One theory is that they're deploying a strategy called predator satiation, where you come out in huge numbers all at once, and there's simply too many of y'all for any one individual to have a high risk of being eaten. If you've got a prime number development time, that makes it very difficult for predators to synchronize with you. The other idea is they have prime number broods to maintain species distinctions and range distinctions. There's some weird math that goes into that, quite frankly, I don't understand. I'm a naturalist. But in general, evolving toward a prime number tends to maintain the integrity of a particular brood and keeps it distinct from adjacent ones. because this is a phenomenon that only happens every 13 or 17 years at one site, it's really difficult to understand what's going on. If somebody like me is trying to study this, you only get to see it four or five times in your life, and then your ticket's punched. Do you have big plans for the upcoming emergence? I'm anxiously looking forward to them. I'm going to organize some field trips for some of my students. It's a phenomenon I think everybody ought to try and experience because it is so unique. The behaviors are really cool when they come up, contrary to the annual cicadas, the dog day cicadas that come up every year. These guys are completely unaware. They don't care if you pick them up. They don't mind a bit. So you get an opportunity to observe them. They're beautiful animals. They sing otherworldly songs. The Tresedim, in particular, has a song that sounds more like a spaceship than it does an insect. It's just impressive to see, you know, thousands and thousands of one insect on a tree, yelling their little heads off from the canopy. Between this and the eclipse, April's turning out to be quite the month for rare natural phenomenon. Yep, the good thing about this one, he says, is it lasts a whole lot longer than 2.5 minutes. That ends the article. But as a native of Chicago area, I can really remember the 17-year locust coming out once while I was a child. It's unbelievable. You think they were different leaves in the trees, but they're bugs. And they drop off and land in your head, sometimes on your hair. They don't bite or sting or do anything. And the sound is weird, to say this. Say the least. Try to hear anything else going on when it's at the very peak. However, we're not seeing the Chicago brood. We're seeing the 13 years around North Carolina. Okay, that's enough for my color commentary on that. Let's move ahead. I've mentioned this before, and the actual events have already happened. But I'll say them again. The Antiques Roadshow, the PBS TV series, which is 28th season, filmed, taped in North Carolina, and those three broadcasts have already been aired at least once this year on PBS stations. They came to the North Carolina Museum of Art earlier this year, and it was their second visit to Raleigh, and it drew thousands of people from across the state, each lugging thrift store finds and decades-old heirlooms, in the hopes of striking gold. And a press release said one guest did just that. The unnamed participant was astounded to find that a $15 thrift store painting was revealed to be a $100,000 treasure by Vietnamese artist Le Pho, made around 1950. Anyway, other surprises are sure to be in store this season, with Roadshow having also visited Anchorage, Sturbridge, Massachusetts, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Akron, Ohio, in addition to Raleigh. Roadshow executive producer Marsha Bemko said in this press release, "We have a big season ahead, which includes locations rich in history, alongside items and guests that reveal hidden stories, first-person experiences, and some whopping values. And I was touched," she said, "to see items from PBS icons Fred Rogers and Bob Ross made their way to the show. And those episodes premiered," that means they'll be shown again, April 1, 8, and 15, just a couple of days ago. And often you'll see them, YouTube, begin to carry excerpts or even entire broadcasts. So you can watch out for that if you happen to have missed it before. Antiques Roadshow. And let's see, here we have President Biden and Vice President Harris celebrating their administration's record of expanding health care access in Raleigh. That was just a few days ago on Tuesday. It highlights their administration's efforts to expand access as Democrats aim to contrast their approach with that of Republicans on that issue. This month, Democrats are celebrating the 14th anniversary of the Affordable Care Act, along with the 21 million individuals who enrolled in coverage under its plan this year, marking the highest enrollment since the law was enacted in 2010. on Tuesday at Chavis Community Center on the city's southeast side. Biden, who helped pass the Affordable Care Act 14 years ago, said the law, quote, is the most consequential health care since Medicare and Medicaid. I stood by President Obama when he signed it into law, and as many of you know, I thought it was a big deal. It's even a bigger deal today, he added. He seized upon this milestone, who would believe it, to criticize Republicans, highlighting their persistent efforts over the past decade to repeal either portions or the entirety of the law, saying they've tried to repeal it 50 times and we've stopped them every time. Before beginning her speech, Vice President Harris paused to address the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore after a massive container ship lost power and crashed into it early Tuesday morning. This is a couple Tuesdays ago. Currently, at least six people, believed to be members of a construction crew, still unaccounted for. Harris said she spoke to Maryland Governor Wes Moore this morning and has directed the federal government to assist the search and rescue mission. President's remarks, and again this was a couple weeks ago, briefly interrupted by a few pro-Palestinian protesters who shouted, what about health care in Gaza? The women continued to shout, ceasefire now, as they were escorted out of the venue. They have a point, Biden responded. We need to get a lot more care into Gaza, he said, to a smattering of applause. Anyway, since Biden took office, North Carolina, along with three other states, has expanded Medicaid after several years of resistance from the state's Republican-led legislature. The American Rescue Plan, ARP, a pandemic recovery measure signed by Biden, provided financial incentives for states to extend Medicaid coverage to low-income residents. In a speech introducing the President and Vice President, Governor Roy Cooper said the $1.6 billion from this plan helped garner support from Republican lawmakers for the expansion. And he said more than 350,000 people have signed up for newly expanded Medicaid in North Carolina, and that number is expected to reach 600,000. Quote, with all of this momentum, it's our job to protect this health care from politicians who want to take it away, and they are out there. Fortunately, we have a president who isn't just protecting it, but is working to expand it. A newly released article from IndieWeek is all about cannabis curious, the hemp generation. With a baby strapped to her chest, a supermom ready to change a diaper at a moment's notice, Chloe Blesch doesn't mince words about the industry she landed in 6 years ago. She says, gesturing at her young daughter, I tell everyone, I lose more sleep from stress about the business than I do from her. Especially with the industry now, it changes quickly. It's like, are you doing enough? Are you growing quickly enough? We need a bigger space. We need more funds, more sales. We need to maximize production. Blesch's well-justified wishes could apply to any small business in the Triangle, but hemp generation, her flagship business that she co-founded with Luis Rubio in 2018, deals in the cannabis industry. Scattered across three storefronts in Wake County, Hemp Generation sells CBD and THC products for those seeking a gentler experience with cannabis. The company's homegrown manufacturing setup is not massive. Blesch's desk is strewn with lab reports, while employees in the adjacent rooms funnel cannabis flower into jars and stick aesthetically pleasing labels onto glass tubes. Blesch stands at the desk and rocks side to side, her baby cooing quietly despite the hustle and bustle. Blesch and Rubio pride themselves on providing education to and comfort for their customers. Each storefront feels clean, almost clinical. Colorful posters on the wall describe the differences between THC and CBD, or the benefits of terpenes, T-E-R-P-E-N-E-S, bioactive compounds present in hemp. Hemp Generation's blog posts dating back to 2022 dive into the benefits of different types of THC or ways to incorporate CBD into your routine. Bless said she contracted Lyme disease, and that's what got her interested in alternative ways of healing. She says, that's what took my interest. Cannabis was a new industry, so it dealt with business and that whole holistic aspect too, helping other people. The medical system doesn't work for everybody, so being able to offer high-quality alternative products is interesting. So why the stress? Well, cannabis is, understandably, a polarizing topic. Its legality is barely understood, and what few laws do exist are enforced variably from county to county in North Carolina. Phil Dixon, a teaching assistant professor and the director of public defense education at UNC Chapel Hill, spells it out in simple terms. He explains, the theory seems to be that as long as those products don't contain more than 0.3% concentration of Delta 9 THC, they're legal. We only have federal regulation now, and then we have a state law that defines marijuana in the same language that the federal definition uses. To break it down a bit further, Delta 9 THC is the most common naturally occurring cannabinoid in cannabis plants. It's also what gives you that high when you smoke a joint or take an edible, and it's one of the most well-studied and well-known forms of THC. And the 0.3% concentration? Well, that's the only hemp-related law on the books in North Carolina. There's no widespread product testing, no restrictions on other cannabinoids, not even an age limit for the purchase. Dixon says if a plant can leave the farm and pass the test as having a permissible level of Delta 9, it doesn't matter what the other levels are. It doesn't matter what the concentrations are, and it really doesn't matter what you do with it from there. You go into a store, and they might be advertising a vape pen with all those things, plus a legal concentration amount of Delta 9. And there's nothing that says that's improper or illegal. Without the appropriate regulations in place, North Carolina's cannabis industry is the Wild West of alternative medicine. Some companies like Hemp Generation strive for health advocacy in the cannabis community and stress the importance of research and taking it slow. On the other hand, some unsuspecting consumer could pick up a gummy at the gas station that's technically under the threshold of 0.3 Delta 9 and be in for a hell of a ride, thanks to the presence of additional unadvertised cannabinoids. Bless says, I've heard all those really bad, sad stories. Now consumers are coming to us, and we kind of have to fix it and paint the picture better. Like, this is what you should have been told. You should have tried something smaller. Work your way up in dosage. To curb the potential for an unpleasant experience, Hemp Generation's products are explicitly, quote, natural and accurately represented, according to the website. Each product listing includes a lab report certifying the percentage of cannabinoids, CBD, and THC present within the Delta 9 gummies or CBD tinctures you may be interested in buying. That said, not every company will go to such lengths. The lack of legislation, combined with a deficiency of standardized guidance for law enforcement, creates gray areas, ripe for businesses to take advantage of gaps in hemp law. According to Dixon, the emphasis law enforcement places on marijuana prohibition varies from county to county, even from agency to agency. Different law enforcement officers within one county may even treat it differently. Dixon says some jurisdictions have thrown up their hands and said, we're not going to enforce the prohibition anymore. We're just not going to prioritize it. It's one thing if you have a trailer full, but if you have just a small amount, many places aren't really prosecuting it. A blanket policy legalizing recreational marijuana in North Carolina wouldn't fix everything either. Not only would it be extremely difficult to pass a Republican-controlled House, but smaller, homegrown companies like Hemp Generation would suffer at the hands of Big Hemp. Bliss says, a few years ago, we said, let's legalize cannabis and make it a marijuana program. But now it's come to the point where we have it already. It just needs to be regulated. Letting the big hemp companies come in would actually monopolize the industry for smaller companies. Despite the gray areas and general sense of ambiguity about the future of cannabis in North Carolina, Bliss is keeping an eye on what's in her control, namely production, testing, and customer experience. Hemp Generation is not the only business of its kind in the Triangle, but Bliss and Rubio aim to create a safe space for locals curious as to what cannabis can do for them, everything from pain relief to easing anxiety. Their website includes FAQs under some of their most popular products so consumers can understand what they can expect. Plus, their business model is consultation-based. Blush says, my consultants ask customers, what have you tried before? Have you tried anything? If you haven't tried anything, let's start out with something very, very small. What are your goals? Do you have pain? For newcomers, common sense still applies above all else. Just because there aren't laws on the books doesn't mean the basic rules don't apply. Don't consume hemp in public. Don't drive impaired, and then do your own research. Bliss says, go to a shop you referred to, or explore to see what shops answer your questions. You really have to be your own advocate and do your own research, unfortunately, because there are a lot of bad players in the industry who really don't care about your health. It's also worth keeping the receipts around. If a hemp business provides a certificate of analysis or third-party lab reports guaranteeing a legal product, a consumer can present the proof of purchase to mitigate some of the suspicion surrounding legal cannabis products. It's not necessarily a foolproof method, though, so a private space is still the best place to experiment with hemp. These unwritten guidelines aren't obvious at every shop that sells edibles or THC pre-rolls, but Hemp Generation is dedicated to driving a paradigm shift for the cannabis curious. Blush and Rubio want their customers to understand their body's limits, outline their goals, and start small, preferably with any of Hemp Generation's products. While she still has to deal with hemp's ambiguous legal statutes in the state for the foreseeable future, Blush is generally optimistic about the industry at large, saying, we're mostly here to educate people on cannabis, to offer high-quality products. Most of our products are organic, and we care what goes in behind it all. We're not saying, oh, let's make the strongest thing possible and offer it. I want people to have good options that are realistic. Well, now, I don't often go to the op-ed page. There's no reason not to, but I usually put those letters aside. This is a fairly interesting one. It's written by Nate Baker, who's actually, I forget, he's a public official of some form. But in other words, this op-ed is about Duke University. And he says, on this centennial, it's time for Duke to strengthen its partnership with Durham through direct payments in lieu of taxes. This was published on the 17th of April. This year, Duke is celebrating its 100 years since its founding as a university here in the Bull City. During the past century, Duke has grown into one of the most prestigious universities in the world with top-notch research, highly selective admissions, a world-class hospital system, and a multi-billion-dollar endowment. The campus footprint has grown as well, making Duke the city's largest and wealthiest private landowner. As it has grown, Durham, too, has grown and evolved into an economically diverse mid-sized city. Over the decades, alongside positive changes, many of Durham's poor and working class communities have felt the impacts of redlining, underinvestment, gentrification, and displacement. Today, Durham finds itself at a crossroads. We are a prosperous city, but one where growing wealth is lopsided, helping some residents while harming others. At the cornerstone of this reality is Duke University, which is currently tax-exempt and pays taxes on only a small portion of its properties, while benefiting handsomely from the amenities, services, and opportunities provided by the city that surrounds it. After 100 years, it's time for Duke University and the Duke University Health System to begin making annual payments in lieu of property taxes to the city of Durham and Durham County. It is true that Duke has its own community programs, and the university should continue those as a good neighbor and partner to the city. However, residents and small businesses across Durham contribute their time, resources, and energy to the community and pay their fair share in taxes. We function together as a society because we pool our resources and make collective democratic decisions through our local government. The university and health system can ensure the tax burden is more fairly distributed and more people in our city share in our growing prosperity. These institutions have an opportunity to commit to making up the revenue that is lost from tax-exempt properties. This would transform Durham for years to come by providing millions of dollars to support crucial city and county services like city worker wages, schools, community health and safety, affordable housing, relief for low-income homeowners, infrastructure, and other vital services. On its 100th year anniversary, Duke University should sit down in good faith with local government officials and a broad and growing community coalition and make a serious financial commitment that will offer opportunity, safety, and dignity to our residents. In beginning to make payments, Duke would join peer institutions such as Yale, University of Pennsylvania, Cornell, Princeton, Dartmouth, Brown, and others who have already deepened their partnership with their respective communities by making significant payments in lieu of taxes. This would go far to ensuring that Duke pays its fair share, like all the residents and small businesses in our community. That again from Nate Baker. And now my final article was an interview with the directors of Girls State. That was a documentary that aired April 4th at the Carolina Theater in Durham as part of the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival. This is two directors, Jean Moss and Amanda McBain, and I will give their responses irregardless of their actual names in the question and answer. And it begins 10 minutes into Girls State, a documentary about what it would look like if teen girls from Missouri ran things for a week. A 17-year-old named Maddie starts to question the mock government camp's star-spangled feminism. "Something about this feels sexist," she says during a song and dance exercise, dropping her arms. "If the boys don't have to do this, I'm going to be so pissed." The camper beside her agrees. Girls State, a program sponsored by the American Legion, is held annually in every state alongside a companion program, Boys State. Curiosity about the siloed boys program just across campus runs high with these girls. It's easy to go into Girls State with qualms that the film will lean on tired girl boss tropes or revel in portraying a feminist utopia while neglecting intersectionality. But directors Jesse Moss and Amanda McBain are smart and self-aware in chronicling the summer program for high school juniors, striking a tone somewhere between a riveting election night broadcast and Bo Burnham's coming-of-age tearjerker, Eighth Grade. It's a follow-up to the 2020 documentary Boys State, also directed by Moss and McBain, which centered on this program in Texas. The Indies spoke with Moss and McBain about how it came to be. The idea, let's see. What about the Girl State and Boy State programs spoke to you as documentary filmmakers? In 2017, the country was being torn apart, the answer. Trump was president. Our divisions were and still are so pronounced. We were looking to make sense of our country, future, and democracy. We'd read about the Texas Boys State program, and we liked the idea that these programs could be a window into young people coming of age in this moment. This idea of civil discourse, have we lost it? Or can we still talk to each other despite our political differences? Here was a laboratory to explore that question with 17-year-olds. We thought this could be a total bomb. But we went to Texas, and it was extraordinary. We knew even before we filmed Boy State that Girl State needed to be a part of this conversation. We weren't sure where we would make it, but we knew why. What does Girl State reflect about the state of polarization? What perceptions does it uphold? What does it debunk? When we were casting the people we were going to follow through the week, we ended up talking to hundreds of kids and about politics. It was really interesting. This is true in Boy State, too. How few of them identified as one party or another. They hadn't yet had to vote, be forced to actually check a box, so their politics seemed to be more a la carte. They seemed to identify more as independents, and they were open to listening to one another in a way I knew they were just more excited to have those conversations than I feel like I hear of my contemporaries. So I think that gave me a feeling of hope that we can hearken back to that space of not being put into two tribes and remember the humanity of it all. It was a question for us, too. Do girls do things differently? We watched how the boys behaved in Boys State, and I won't spoil the film, but I'll say it's pretty tribal. There's lots of chest thumping and push-ups. You see dirty tricks. We had people say to us, oh, with girls, it's going to be mean girls. It's going to be a catfight. But that's not at all what we saw. And I must now apologize for ending this way short of what I'd hoped to read to you. It's available, though, at indieweek.com. Look for Teenage Dreams, speaking with the directors of Girls State. Very enlightening article in many respects. Well, John Fetterson has to bid farewell to you until our next issue of Indie Week, which will come up in this. The recording, by the way, is always available as our previous issues on the podcast section of North Carolina Reading Service. So for ncreadingservice.org, we thank you all for listening to us. John Fetterson now says farewell for this week.